few months, as more and more women have spoken out about harassment in Hollywood, the tech industry, media companies, and the restaurant industry, much less attention has been paid to working-class women at blue-collar jobs who have faced abuse for years and have largely been ignored. In a recent investigation for the New York Times called How Tough Is It to Change a Culture of Harassment? Ask Women at Ford. Susan Shearer, a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues, and Katrin Einhorn, an investigative reporter, reveal the persistence of harassment in an industry once dominated solely by men at the Ford plant in Chicago. They uncovered decades of ongoing abuse, despite the fact that women were in one of the country's most powerful unions, and despite the fact that a federal agency and a federal judge had sided with them, and even after independent monitors policed the factory floors for years. The article appears on the New York Times website, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Susan Shearer and Katrin Einhorn to our show today. Thank you both for coming, or calling in.
Thank you so much.
How did you both first become aware of this problem at Ford?
Katrin?
We were both looking into issues of sexual harassment among women who are not as wealthy and powerful as the ones we had been hearing from. You know, it was actually, we started this reporting when the Weinstein investigation was happening but had not been published yet. And Susan started looking into blue-collar industries, construction, shipyards. And I was looking into some of that too, mining, but I was also looking into service workers, you know, hotel housekeepers, restaurant workers, and we were just looking around and really looking for the right kind of story to tell that was going to really allow us to make some contribution. You know, there had been some great reporting done already, like Frontline in 2013 and 2015 has done really great work on janitorial workers and the sexual assaults that they face and agricultural workers,
exactly.
Yeah, we wanted to sort of push it a little. We wanted it to push it and reveal something new. And we came across this case at Ford where there had been accusations of sexual harassment, as you said in the intro, in the 90s, you know, big federal action, millions of dollars paid out, big, policy changes put in place to try and prevent this from happening again. And so we were fascinated to find that, oh my gosh, just in August of 2017, it's all happening again. There's a federal investigation that leads to a settlement, millions of dollars promised and promises to change. And so we wanted to look at how could this happen? How did this happen again?
And so you spoke with more than 100 current and former employees about their experiences, which is a lot. That's pretty impressive. Were many of them reluctant to come forward and speak with you?
Yes, we did have a lot of trouble persuading the majority of the workers we interviewed to let us use their names. Some workers we spoke with either were already outed, if you will, because they were in a lawsuit, or they had decided that they felt comfortable using their names. But most did not, because what they had seen is that the workers who spoke out were often retaliated against by their coworkers. Some of the women described having their car tires slashed, or one woman was told she was raping the company, and in some cases by supervisors who put them on, you know, jobs that were undesirable or physically grueling, and they just faced a lot of hostility and denigration.
So, and that's something that we found across these kinds of industries, right, is that the very nature of these jobs in factories or on construction sites or in mines can lend itself to that kind of, you know, women can actually be in danger in some cases if they're speaking out. In the Ford factories, danger wasn't as much of an issue as we see in some other industries, but like something that women described a lot was these sort of small humiliations like being denied bathroom breaks or being put on jobs. You know, women told us stories of sort of working their way up from like the really sort of heavy, you know, undesirable jobs that they would start out at, and sort of over time having a job that was a more pleasant job to do that didn't involve sort of this sort of grueling repetition of some of the line work, and then they would complain and all of a sudden they would be back where they started.
Right. So these were sort of common themes among their experiences for both men and women?
Yeah, I mean, definitely we found that women experience this, and then some men have told us about everybody wants these good jobs, and usually you get them through seniority, but men would sometimes either say that, you know, they, if they spoke out for women, you know, they were often accused of sleeping with the women. So they, like, if they were protecting the women, they're having an affair. That's why he's protecting her. So, you know, it was like you kind of had different kinds of rumors.
It's kind of a multi-headed monster, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Ford officials told you that they viewed the harassment as episodic, not systemic. What did they mean by that?
Okay, I can explain.
Talk about that.
No problem. I had ended up, Catherine and I did a lot of this work together, but I ended up talking more extensively to the folks at Ford as we divided it up. And essentially what happened is there was, since women began doing more regular work in Ford auto plants from the 1970s on, they had actually encountered pretty horrific harassment. But in the 1990s, they began reaching for legal and federal investigatory remedies. So the first lawsuit and the first set of Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigations and settlements were in the 90s. And at that point, Ford and the EEOC agreed to a settlement, as Catherine had mentioned, millions of dollars, and independent monitors came to oversee it. And for a period of a few years, in the early 2000s, everybody agrees that things got quieter, as the women put it to us. Hmm. You know, the monitors were there. They were looking at how sexual harassment complaints were investigated. They were talking, interviewing women to see what their experiences were like. You know, Ford was implementing very extensive sexual harassment training. One of the women we spoke with had conducted some of that training and seen some men's eyes opened. And then what happened was the monitors left and the auto industry itself began getting threatened. This was as you get to like 2007, 2008.
Right.
You know, you have the verge of bankruptcy. In any case, these issues seem to get less sustained attention and pressure, and the harassment, which had never really been fully eradicated as a culture, began sweeping up. So, you know, Ford saw it as these spikes by 2010, 2011, when they were hiring again, and thousands of workers were coming into the factories, their level of complaints started shooting up, and Ford took notice. But I think our conclusion was, after talking to so many people, is that it was more sustained because the deep-set attitudes and the sense that there was a certain impunity about it had not gone away.
So, Susan, Shirley Kane, who was an employee who arrived at the stamping plant 5 years ago and had to fend off advances from coworkers and supervisors, had told you that company executives, quote, don't even go on the floor, so they don't know what goes on, unquote.
Well, it's very interesting. Catherine has been preparing. We understand that the CEO of Ford, Jim Hackett, is going to pay a visit to the factories possibly tomorrow, possibly today. Catherine, why don't you talk a little about that?
Oh, really? Yeah,
you know, it, sort of in the aftermath of the story, the CEO of Ford, Jim Hackett, actually did apologize, which is something that the company, you know, hadn't done in the 90s. They had settled, but they had never admitted liability, as is so often the case in these settlements, right? And then, again, there has been an EEOC settlement in August in which the same thing happened. They settled for millions of dollars but didn't admit liability. And, you know, some of the women who we were interviewing, particularly one who was part of a lawsuit in the 90s. Her name is Suzette Wright. She was sort of desperate for an apology. That's what she most wanted. She felt like in order to really address the wrongdoing and change this culture, at first you had to acknowledge it. You had to acknowledge that there had been wrongdoing and you had to apologize for it. And she spoke very eloquently about that. And in fact, he did apologize. And in this open letter that he wrote, he also said that he was going to be coming to the factories. And we know that he's going to be at the assembly plant, which is on the far south side of Chicago, tomorrow. And we've heard from workers, although it's not confirmed, that he may be at the stamping plant, which is in suburban Chicago, today. Unfortunately, Ford doesn't want to let us you know, of course, as reporters, we asked, hey, can we come? We would love to cover this. We would,
yeah.
I mean, what a fascinating dialogue that might be between Mr. Hackett and any of the workers he's talking to. And they want to keep it in-house. So we've just been sort of getting updates from some of the workers themselves that we're in touch with.
So, Katrin, when did women start holding permanent jobs on the line at Ford in Chicago? I mean, have women been working there during World War II and beyond? And I mean,
it's so funny that you asked that question. So we, of course, had that question. We thought that would be a really easy question to answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, it wasn't. And eventually we did come up with answers that we were satisfied with, but it was so hard. I thought that historians in Chicago would be able to tell me. I thought that certainly, like, you know, Susan asked the Ford PR people, and I called the Ford Museum in Michigan, and we thought that they would be able to tell us. But in fact, no one could tell us, A, whether there were women in the plant during World War II, or B, when women actually took permanent jobs on the line. So in the end, the person who helped us crack it was this man who runs this little tiny historical society on the southeast side of Chicago, and he had some photographs from the 1940s of the assembly plant with a woman who's dressed in the outfits that many of the women working in the plants were in. And we talked to enough old-timer workers who said, yeah, we remember women being in there in World War II, and then when women first held permanent jobs was in the 70s. But that was a really hard, it was just shockingly hard to pin down as reporters. We thought that was going to be a very easy question to answer.
Yeah, that's funny because, I mean, having, for example, gone and visiting sort of mining museums and the like, there's more documentation and record of women miners, it sounds like, than there were of women in the car manufacturing. That's really interesting.
It may have just been this particular plant, right?
Sure.
I mean, certainly Ford has lots of evidence of women, World War II, mm-hmm. women who went into the factories and helped, you know, a lot of those factories were turned over, of course, as was the assembly plant, mm-hmm. to the manufacturer. You know, they stopped civilian production. They started manufacturing war vehicles.
Right.
So in the assembly plant, they were manufacturing armored cars that were, like, mine resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the Ford Museum does have documentation of those women being in those factories in many other states. It was just that they couldn't pin it down in Chicago. And, you know, they also, you know, did emphasize that when the war was over, the women were scuttled. You know, the men,
right.
The women had to leave, and
right.
the men had to come back to their jobs. Now, I should say that, you know, Henry Ford, way back when, did have women working in the factories very early, but not on sort of the production line with men. They had totally different jobs, doing some,
right.
in the early days, like some sort of small, like things that required sort of small, nimble hand things, but they weren't like assembling cars.
So do you have a sense of what percentage of employees there today are women?
It's a little
under,
if you take both plants, it's a little under a third, right, Susan?
That's right.
So
yeah.
You write that a job at Ford was sort of considered a golden ticket. Was the high salary and benefits an incentive to put up with a lot of abuse from coworkers and supervisors? I mean, aside from the ramifications of reporting and the fear involved in that and the retaliation, you know, it was considered a pretty good job.
Absolutely. I think what we both found is that these jobs are extraordinarily desirable. You know, they pay really well. You don't have to have a college degree.
Right.
They have very good benefits. So women put up with a lot. Nobody wants to lose these jobs. And what we found is that a number of women in the earlier lawsuit and settlement, they, for sort of complex reasons that are a matter of each side says one thing or another, but several of the women felt coerced to give up their jobs if they received monetary settlements. And a number of those women really never recovered their standard of living. They just, even if they got a nice payout, it didn't last their whole lives. And in some cases, women we interviewed had college degrees. They had started as teachers, but they moved because the salary they could get with overtime, you know, could approach, in certain cases, a six-figure salary.
Right.
And it's very hard to get that kind of money.
Not to mention the pension.
You bet.
That comes from, you know, spending a lifetime or a large part of your lifetime at one company. You also uncovered what you described as a quote-unquote robust underground with where there's sex, drugs, and guns and liquor bought and sold after hours at the actual plant. And so how long had that existed? And was management aware of it? Or do you even know how it developed in the first place?
It's so interesting. I think that a lot of factories have these kinds of underground economies.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of people together, and they're in a confined space. And a lot of them are scrappy people who are gonna make a buck.
Sure.
We heard stories. I mean, especially in the 80s and 90s. I mean, the stories that the workers tell are sort of stunning. You could buy anything in the plants. They say, and everything from Christmas presents for your kids, you need some clothes, you need like t-shirts,
mm-hmm.
underwear, anything, televisions, but also outside there would be, workers told us stories, numerous workers told us stories of prostitutes that would wait outside in the parking lot. And there were also, you could buy, when you were leaving the plant, you could buy liquor from people who would just sell liquor out of like the back of their pickup truck. There was also a meat guy where you could buy if you needed
right.
the pork shoulder or whatever you needed to take home to your family for dinner, you could buy that in the parking lot of the plant. Now, a lot of that I think has been tamped down. It's not sort of the wild
sure.
west that it used to be in the 80s and 90s.
But historically,
but
when you have
people
that,
people still talk
yeah.
about things you can buy in the plant. Like you know the guy you go to get whatever you want.
So just historically, in that culture of sort of secrecy and, sort of, as you call it, an underground economy, as it were, it becomes much easier, in fact, to get away with abuse and harassment. And women are very often, or most likely, targets of that. But given that, most of the women who ended up suing, ultimately, are African-American women. So how does race play a role in this story?
Yeah, this is really important. The two plants are somewhat different. The assembly plant, which is the far larger of the two, is 70% non-white, and the stamping plant is, slight majority white. So the atmosphere is different, but a lot of our protagonists are African-American, both harassers and harassed. And both plants were not only the target of sexual harassment lawsuits, they were the target of and EEOC investigations, racial harassment, EEOC investigation, settlement, and lawsuits. So sex and race were quite intertwined, and in some cases the kinds of insults were racial slurs as well as sexual slurs. There were situations where workers felt that white workers were promoted more to quasi-management or leadership or better positions. Space didn't allow us to as fully explore that as we would have liked, but there are a lot of ways in which they play off each other.
I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Susan Shira, a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues at the New York Times, and Katrin Einhorn, an investigative reporter for the Times. We are talking about their story on the persistence of harassment at Ford. Hi, I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Susan Shira, a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues at the New York Times, and Katrin Einhorn, an investigative reporter for the Times, about their article, How Tough Is It to Change a Culture of Harassment? Ask Women at Ford. So, Katrin, didn't you find that veteran female employees warned that reporting behavior really only brought more trouble? You had spoken to one woman, Suzette Wright, who was told by a union official, someone representing her, quote, Suzette, you're a pretty woman, take it as a compliment. And this was after she had attempted to file an official complaint?
That's right. One of the, what I think ended up being most traumatic for women often was not the harassment itself, but the lack of recourse that they found. So these
yeah.
things would be happening, and then they would, women would say, better just to keep it quiet. You know what happened to this woman when she said something, nothing happened, and then she got put on the harder jobs. And so they would sort of, and then, in Suzette's case, for example, so at first she took that advice from the women who'd been there longer than her, and
mm-hmm.
she didn't say anything. She'd been, from the very first day, she was experiencing stuff,
mm-hmm.
men yelling fresh meat during orientation, people yelling P peanut butter legs when she walked up to the line, and she didn't know for months. She didn't know why people, why are all these men calling out peanut butter legs?
Yeah.
And then finally she asks this guy who she was kind of friendly with and persuades him to tell her, and he says, Suzette, they're talking about you. Not only is it the color of your legs, but it's the kind of legs you like to spread.
Ugh.
And, you know, she's just floored. You know, she's been going, she's been the butt of this joke for months. But, you know, she's like, oh, I better not say anything. Eventually, she has this incident happen where this man who she considered a mentor basically, you know, says he wished he had paid her $5 for a blowjob.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, she was really, really devastated. And that's when she went to the union. And she said, listen, I want to report this. And as she says, that started the campaign. It was just this campaign about don't file a complaint against Bill, because, oh, Bill is going to lose his job. Bill is going to lose his pension. You can't do this to his family.
Right. All the concern focused on Bill.
That's right. And, you know, culminating in her finding this very high-ranking union official out waiting for her by her car. And that's when he tells her, you know, just take it as a compliment. You're a pretty woman.
So, you know, obviously enduring all of this harassment, and also the disappointment of finding out that the people that you have good relationships with are actually undermining you and not interested in your safety or your success at work. There's a psychological toll that sexual harassment and abuse can take on people. And on people like Suzette. Did she end up having to take any kind of medical leave for anxiety or depression?
Yes. Yeah. She had to take an extended. She was in the hospital. You know, they wanted to commit her. Actually, she became so traumatized by the end. And the only reason they didn't actually have her stay there, you know, inpatient, was because she had young kids, and so she was just in getting treatment, you know, from 9 to 5 every day. And she wasn't the only one. You know, it was really. These women sort of reached a breaking point. And Suzette put it really eloquently. She said, you know, she would just kind of stand there and take it again and again. It just diminished herself as a person until all that was left was a shell. And I actually spoke with a psychiatrist who treated a bunch of these women. She just happens to be a psychiatrist who practices near where a lot of these women live. And I found out about her through one of the women, and it turned out that she had treated several. And, of course, she's very limited, and she couldn't speak specifically about any of her patients. But she really emphasized this idea that the trauma came from the lack of recourse, you know, that these women, they were strong women. These were not emotionally weak women, she said. These are actually really strong women who would go and take a factory job to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But what they when they experienced this abuse, and there was no way for them to get out of it, and they were scared about who they could tell and who they couldn't tell. That's what really ate away at them.
And it becomes abuse from both sides. So,
right.
So you also found instances of bosses who were actually rewarding employees with cushier jobs and more benefits in exchange for sexual favors. So who is Miyoshi Morris?
Right. So Miyoshi Morris is one of the women that we interviewed. She had worked at Ford since the early 90s. And she told us about a particular supervisor who had essentially, she had young children, and she was having trouble getting to work on time because she had to find childcare that would open its doors before 6 a.m. when she had to beat her shift. And so she was piling up latenesses, and he said to her, you're in trouble, but I can fix it for you. But you got to put up, essentially, and put out. And so she did. And this was part of a culture that we found where there was a kind of a trade where, you know, some women wanting desirable jobs would flirt with or sleep with supervisors. Other women were threatened or coerced into doing so. And Miyoshi very bravely told about her own situation and the shame that she battled afterwards.
So why did she eventually decide that this was something that she felt she needed to do?
Well, you know,
her manager was named Myron Alexander, I believe.
Right. So Mr. Alexander, who unfortunately did not respond to repeated attempts for us to get comments, so we only have Miyoshi's account here, but Miyoshi explained that this had gone on and that she then felt that she had really been you know, kind of pushed into it, and she didn't want to do this anymore. And later on, she was fired for the company believed that she had falsified a request for bereavement leave. She contested that, but in any case, she had been fired.
Did she?
And she had joined the lawsuit, and
right.
she'd been fired. But
she'd been fired subsequent to joining the lawsuit, or after filing a complaint?
You know what? I want to be careful. Catherine, can you remember the time frame here?
I want to be careful about the timing too, but you know, the reason that she says that she was ultimately fired
right.
was because she was put in another situation, she says, with a different man, in this case, the top union official at Chicago Assembly, whose name is Kobe Millender, and she basically went to him for help getting her job back.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he said sort of the same thing to her, like, if you want your job back, then you're going to have to get down on your knees and act more like this other woman. And this, he gestured toward this other woman who Miyoshi understood to be in a sexual relationship with him. And so at that point, Miyoshi said, I couldn't compromise myself again. And,
yeah.
and she did not agree to that. And she did not, you know, she let it go.
Is she now working somewhere else today? Has she moved on professionally?
Yes, yeah, she works as an esthetician. So she does hair and mm-hmm. skin and so on. But she's earning a fraction of what she would have earned at Ford.
Right. So, Catherine, part of what makes this pervasive harassment and this culture at Ford so completely outrageous is the fact that these are workers that are protected by one of the most powerful unions, labor unions in the country, the United Automobile Workers. So, and did you find that when one union member accuses another of sexual harassment, it causes divisions within the union itself? I mean, can you talk a bit about the systemic problems with the union as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, there's an inherent conflict of interest, right? Because it's one thing if an hourly worker, a woman who's an hourly worker, is accusing a salaried worker. Then that does not create such an inherent conflict of interest. But when an hourly worker is accusing another hourly worker, then what is the union supposed to do? They have to represent both those workers, the accuser
right.
and the accused. And, you know, we spoke with one union official, who, not an official, like a representative, you know, a union rep, who talked about that. And he talked about sitting in a meeting where he was, often it's the same union rep who's going to serve both people, right? Because they work in the same section, they work maybe on the line next to each other in many cases. And so this was a situation where he was representing both the accuser and the accused, and in the end, it was the woman who prevailed, and the man was fired. And mm-hmm. he just recalled the man looking at him like, why couldn't you do something for me? And he felt really bad. He talked about how torn he felt because, you know, he didn't know whether the woman was telling the truth in this instance. And, you know, we've spoken with for example, one of the independent monitors who was put in place after that federal action in the 90s, and so, you know, he was there for 3 years really watching how Ford was implementing these changes and trying to deal with this problem, and he's done that for other factories. And he said that false accusations are a real problem. You know, it would be really wrong to assume that every woman is telling the truth all the time, that there are incentives for women to make false accusations
but
at times.
The,
and so you have to police yeah. that carefully.
But the larger question or the larger conflict would seem to be the fact that there is no structural system in place at the union for dealing with these kinds of conflicts or these types of reports and finding a way to not only advocate for the reporter, but for the accused in a way that can be objectively managed and handled and sensitively managed and handled. In other words, and part of me wonders if the problem is because union leadership is mostly male, that they haven't developed a real structure for or handling this kind of inquiry or this kind of conflict. Is that the case?
I can address that to some extent. It's really complicated, right? Because discipline is handled by the company.
Sure.
Ford in this case. So Ford investigates, Ford decides on a discipline. What the union does is contractually it has the right to a grievance procedure, so it protests or advocates for the workers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the issue is, like one of the union folks we talked to thought maybe one potential answer would be to try to get, when you have a situation where the same union rep's involved, maybe you get some outside person to come and try to adjudicate. I mean, unions haven't really systematically wrestled with this conflict. A lot of them say, hey, we managed to do it. We managed to do it. People get punished. We support them through the system. But I think that there hasn't been a great deal of thinking about, would there be some third party until it gets up to the arbitration, which is sort
right.
of the top, very top level of a grievance chain.
Right. Right. I mean, these are things that I think a lot of different unions, including my own, you know, entertainment unions are actually looking at, that there needs to be some kind of objective third party looking at these kinds of investigations that are useful to the union member, because you can't really always rely on the industry or the employer to handle it. So because isn't there currently a lawsuit against Ford which is accusing multiple union reps, local union reps, of harassing women or obstructing their complaints? At this stage?
Yes.
Reps and officials.
That's correct.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Not only union reps, but union officials.
Union officials.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
Kobe Millender, who we mentioned before, who's the highest ranking official at Chicago Assembly, has, you know, several women accusing him of sexual misconduct. And he declined an interview, but we had a brief conversation with him in which, you know, he denied that and said that he has a very upstanding record, but that is the case. I mean, it's not just that there is this conflict of interest; it's that union representatives and officials, many of them, have been accused, and many of them are also really lauded by the women, and some of them have really worked tirelessly for women who have been involved in these problems. So it's a mixed bag.
So, and this Alan Millender, he's a top union official at Chicago Assembly.
That's right. Kobe. He goes by Kobe.
Kobe. Oh, I see.
Name is
Alan.
It's the same guy.
Okay, I see. So you found that the Chicago Assembly plant was sort of unique in terms of the high number of complaints, but they did hire outside monitors. And has it gotten, you know, for a time you write that many women said the plant had sort of seemed quieter. Has that remained the case?
Well, what happened was that was the case in the early 2000s. From the first settlement, so it was a 3-year oversight period, and then, as I mentioned, with the departure of the monitors and the advent of like an economic catastrophe, and then a new hiring spree, the complaints started spiking up again. And at one point, by 2015, mm-hmm. The two Chicago plants accounted for more than half of all sexual harassment claims at Ford.
So,
Chicago was a very special, distinct, outrageous example.
Right. And in our last 20 seconds, why do you think it's so important to include the experiences of blue-collar women in this national conversation about harassment?
We need to hear their voices. They have particular problems, they have fewer resources, and they have really overt and arduous harassment. They're vulnerable.
And because of course, the economic stakes are so high for these women as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, because we're talking about blue-collar work doesn't necessarily mean we're not talking about careers that matter and careers that can affect the economy of their local communities at large.
They're supporting families.
Yes, exactly. I've been speaking with Susan Shira, a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues at the New York Times, and Katrin Einhorn, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. We've been talking about their story on the persistence of harassment at Ford Motor Company, and I thank them both so much for joining us today to talk about this very important subject. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you so much.